Black Lives Matter. It's more than a rallying cry for protesters. It's a movement that has inspired and motivated a generation. But it has also polarized a country, still wrestling with a legacy of racial discrimination and prejudice. Well, tonight we talk to the co-authors of a new book that examines this social justice conversation. Patrice Gaines and Keith Harrison are just two of the co-authors of Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. If you want to jump in on this conversation, and I'm sure you do, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H. Fisher, W-H-U-R, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Patrice, Keith, thank you so much for joining the conversation. This is like old home week for D.C. reporters.
Right. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. I should say that this book was a project that wasn't just a Patrice Gaines, Keith Harrison project. There are several people that are part of this amazing book. Patrice, I'll start with you, though. What was the genesis of this publishing project?
Well, I have to point to one person, and then we'll talk about the events. But the person who had the idea is Michael Cotman, who Keith and I have worked with at the Washington Post, and we are friends. But Michael had this idea that we should do something about this moment in history that we were all living through. And so he tapped some journalists that he knows. So in addition to Keith and I, there's Nick Charles and Curtis Bunn and Michael Cotman. And so, you know, the idea was to give that this time in history some context, with the hope that when we're gone, that the truth will, you know, be in this book, that people can see that it wasn't just George Floyd, although that was kind of, in some ways, you could say the last straw, or certainly the spark at that time, but there was this accumulation of injustices that Black people have endured. And you know, it just came to that moment when everybody was at home because of the pandemic, and watching also this horrific video over and over and over, and that people actually also had the time to go out and to protest, even worldwide. So that's kind of it I guess.
Mm. When you, Keith, became a part of it, what was, from your perspective, the most poignant piece of participating in, you know, in this project? Like Patrice said, obviously, there was, you know, the George Floyd incident, but certainly there had to be a part of discovery just based on, you know, the title. When you look at, you know, how Black lives came to matter. Did Black lives come to matter?
Yeah. Again, hey, by the way, thanks, Harold, for having us.
Sure.
Get that in too.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
You know, to a degree, and we've had, Patrice and I in particular, have had discussions about the subtitle of our book about, well, have Black lives really come to matter? And to a degree, they have. There have been, mostly on the state and local levels, there have been actual, you know, real reforms and real legislation passed that in many instances changes the way the criminal justice system operates, and in some ways changes the way that the criminal justice system deals with law enforcement officers who happen to be, in those rare occasions, actually charged with misconduct or worse, like in the case of George Floyd. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's still a long, long way for us to go. And one of the things that sort of that came out of this for me was, and it's not like as if, I mean, Patrice and I have been doing this for a while as journalists. it's not as if we didn't know. We know that the impact that systemic racism has had on our community. I mean, we know that, but working on this project, especially doing it essentially, as Cotman likes to say, we essentially did in 6 months' time what would normally take about 2 years from start to finish. But the impact of that on me really, in some ways, just overwhelmed me with the manner in which the systems, the various systems, all supported by systemic racism, have really had a negative impact on our community.
What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, let's take my section of the book focuses on policing. I covered public safety policy as a reporter at the Washington Post and led coverage on those topics as an editor and manager for many years, and was was considered to be an expert at the Washington Post, as a matter of fact, on the subject. Had been recognized as a journalist for my coverage of that topic. It wasn't until I really bore down during this 6 month period from when we decided to do the book to the time when we submitted a completed manuscript that I was able to really drill down in a very narrow way on the history of policing in this country. And I discovered, for example, something that I wish I had known as a reporter covering the issue. And that is that, I've heard people over and over saying, the police departments they police differently in black communities than they do in a white community. And they obviously do. You grew up in a black community, the sort of well-known examples of what happened in New York City under Giuliani with the stop and frisk methodology, where essentially if you were a black male teenager or a Latino walking down the street, it was their policy to stop you to see if you had a weapon on you. Turned out to be a severe violation of civil rights, but they did it. Well, that kind of policing tactic had its roots in slave patrols in this country, which started mostly in the South, Southeast and South, where people created these slave patrols essentially to keep the enslaved in check, especially in those areas where the enslaved outnumbered slave owners. The slave patrols did the same type of thing. They would just, if there were groups of black people standing around, they would go and they'd interrupt and they'd ask questions. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? Move on. Do this. Do this. And those same kinds of tactics have followed, over a couple of centuries, and they're still in practice today in black communities. I mean, how many times it's probably happened to you, Harold, how many times have you stopped when you knew there was a police car behind you, you knew for some reason that you were going to be stopped? And they come up with all kinds of reasons. I couldn't see your license, but you didn't come to a complete stop on a stop sign. Again, the manner in which the law enforcement polices and patrols in our communities are more like to try to keep us in check or to find reasons to place charges against us. And, that to me, it was, and you have similar histories in various, and on various topics. Patrice can talk about this when it comes to incarceration and the history and how that history has continued over hundreds of years and it still manifests itself in a lot of ways.
We are talking to the co-authors of a new book entitled Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. So, Patrice, one of the things when you spoke earlier about, George Floyd, even when we all saw the video, I was amazed at the pushback from some quarters in America, and we all watched the coverage afterwards, that knee on the neck for 9+ minutes, that there were still people who defended the murder of George Floyd. And so, contrary to the title of the book, there are some parts of America that where Black lives just don't matter, even when the video is there metaphorically in black and white.
Oh, absolutely. And I think with our title, I've come to think of it as the fact that the founders of Black Lives Matter have made that phrase matter, you know. But indeed, there's a lot more work to be done to make people matter to the degree that they should. But, you know, I think that the reason we have that pushback is because of our history in this country. When you have enslaved people, and that is the, in some ways, the beginning of a relationship you have had with some people, then you are used to being barbaric. You have founded a relationship on a barbaric history and behavior. And even though that no longer exists as slavery, it set in some ways, I think it's Brian Stevenson who is the justice advocate and attorney. He said slavery gave America a fear of black people and a taste for violent punishment, and both still define our criminal justice system. And I would say they still define also in many ways their relationship with black people. And so once you have established that and then set up many laws, behaviors, all kinds of systems to support that, it doesn't seem as, as surprising. And what that was one of the things that struck me in my research is, you know, I've done stories that talked about criminal justice over decades, really, and this story and that story. But to see it all together, you know, to connect the dots from slavery to when you shackled and killed people, you know, worked them to death, to, when you have caged them and hosed them and done all kinds of, treated them inhumanely, then when you see this, you see that, yeah, there's just a movement from that enslavement, but it's still brutality. You know, we're still in a system that does not fully recognize the humanity of people who are black.
You just said something that struck me. When you talk about the humanity of people who are black, when you talk about specifically those who may be powerless. But what about, you know, the black people who are, you know, powerful? One of the most talked about stories this week in pop culture is the I Told You So Saturday Night Live skit featuring, a parody of Colin Kaepernick saying, I told you so, when talking about, you know, the firing of John Gruden as the who do the Raiders play for? Las Vegas now. They move all over the daggone place. But George Floyd's murder was an I told you so moment. The John Gruden email is an I told you so moment. And yet, you know, Keith, I would argue that some people, particularly some white people, are afraid of I told you so moments.
Yeah. A clear example of that is this nonsense that's going on about critical race theory, where, especially far right groups have seized this, and placed their untruths on the whole debate. You know, critical race theory is not taught in K-12. Critical race theory is taught, if it's taught at all, at the college and university level. But as they are prone to do, they have seized this topic and place their untruths on it and are playing to fears of people about critical race theory. I think that's a really good example of that. It's interesting. One of the people that I interviewed for a long time on the story was a black chief of police for a really small police department. It was about 50 people, 50-person police department in Sunflower, Mississippi. And he comes from a family of police officers. And after the George Floyd's murder, he was on social media and he posted essentially about how he just wanted to try to make sure that nothing like that ever happened again anywhere. He knew he could control it to a large degree in his department, but he just wanted to figure out a way where nothing like that could ever happen. And he explained to me, he said, listen, most of you, and he was talking about me and my co-authors because I'd explained our project. He said, you all sound like you're East Coast people. You know, most police departments in this country are like my department, he said, you know, where we hire people in these small departments and we hire a lot of white people. And most of those white people have never had any relationships with any black people.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they know. Of black people, they get through media. And he said, I can tell you, they see us as thugs. And so they come into the job not having any, you know, a lot of them, and this is a general statement, but I think I believe them, without any kind of interactions with black people. And they have these images of black people superimposed upon them in addition to the history of black people in this country. And he said, they look at us and they see us as thugs. And, what's interesting, Harold, is that...
Hold your point, Keith. Don't forget it, because I'll let you finish. And I want to drill down a little bit more on that issue. We need to take a quick break, but of course, don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com. And don't forget to download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. This conversation about the new book, Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America, will continue in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking to two of the co-authors of a new book that examines a critical social justice conversation of our time. Patrice Gaines and Keith Harrison are co-authors of the new book, Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Keith, finish your point, please.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. One, is the main thing is this. One, you have a lot of white people in law enforcement who don't have any history of dealing with black people. And not only are they the chief law enforcement officers, the majority in this country, but then when things do happen, that warrant being investigated, when things happen where community says this police officer did this wrong, look at them, it's those same people who are doing the investigating. And it's not, and the thing is, it's not just at, you know, in local police departments and state police departments. It goes all the way up like to the Justice Department and the FBI. There is a group of black FBI agents who recently decided to speak out, most of them are recently retired, by the way, to point just that out and said, like, no, there are certainly no black people in decision-making positions in the FBI, which is responsible for investigating wrongdoing by local police departments. And he said, you know, you can't have someone who, say, was raised in, and no offense about, you know, to Nebraska or Iowa, but you can't have someone, this is what they said, someone who was raised in Nebraska and Ohio or Iowa, who's going to look at, say, a police shooting, in Chicago and bring the same experiences that someone who is black will bring to it. And that, you know, that so that this lack of trust of the system just persists. And it's almost like an infinite regression. And unless some changes are made, you know, the hope for change is small.
Yeah. Patrice, what role do you believe that women outside of, you know, the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, but the other incidents or since the start of the movement, what role do you think women have played in helping to grow this movement, to expand it beyond its origins?
Well, you know, you've got a lot of women now who are women coming up in the church. You know, during the civil rights movement, women were kind of pushed back when it came to leadership, and even you know, churches at that time, most churches did not have women in their leadership roles. But today, we see more women in leadership roles in churches, and so many of them are also, you know, leading movements, getting out in the streets, as well as working on police reform and some of the other related issues. So we see that. And then a lot of groups of mothers. I know I live right outside Charlotte, North Carolina, and we've got very strong mothers groups, too, that work with changing, police reform, particularly around how police respond to calls for mental health crises, but also when it comes to just mass incarceration. So I think, you know, we're in an environment now that is more open, certainly, than it was during the civil rights movement to the energy of women. And so you see women getting very involved in that way. And then, of course, we've got a lot of strong women now who are in politics, you know, and leading some of these larger cities and working hard to make some political changes and some changes in the laws.
Mm-hmm. You know, Keith spoke about his, you know, covering of, you know, police and interviewing police and contributing to the book. Talk to me about the thing that struck you, Patrice, as you contributed to the book.
Sure. Well, my section was called Locking Up Black Lives. So I talk about, you know, how we got to this point of mass incarceration and this point where so many black people have criminal records, because we're talking about not only the people who have served time or who are currently incarcerated, but we also have millions of people who are being monitored, you know, who are still on probation. So we've got a lot of black people who are being monitored. And then we've got a lot of black people who, we've got over 5 million people, period, who are convicted felons who cannot vote or, you know, have to go through a process to be able to vote. And I have to say, you know, one of the reasons that I've written over the years about criminal justice was because, you know, at the age of 21, I was busted with possession of heroin and possession of with intent to distribute, and I became a convicted felon. And I saw, you know, I thought that I had escaped because I was able to negotiate only 5 years of probation and a fine. But what I found out was, once you're a convicted felon, the state, the government, does not forgive you. They do not forget that, and they try to punish you in a multitude of ways. So that was one of the things that really got me involved in looking more deeply. And so in doing the research for this book, I guess one of the things that really struck me was when I went all the way back to 1790, when the first penitentiary was built in Philadelphia, you know, ironically, the city of brotherly love, to even find that in that very first penitentiary, the population reflected really what we see in the population of prisons today. They were mostly black people, and they were mostly the poor, unskilled black people, the people, many of them, people who had come from the South to escape slavery and ended up being incarcerated in this penitentiary. And so when I look at from that time until today, very little has changed, you know, about who gets the harshest punishment, you know, who gets even, as Keith talked about, over-policed, you know. And so I looked at that, and then I looked at after slavery in the South, because in the South at first there was no need for prison because we had slavery. But after the Emancipation Proclamation, even then in the North, they began to build prisons because the idea was, you know, they feared that black people would move, these free black people would come, and they needed to have these prisons. But in the South, of course, they went, you know, they built more and more prisons. And then people began to get arrested for black codes, things like walking without a purpose, you know, just ridiculous things. And then we had, after that, of course, we had lynchings. And then we had people who had to work chain gangs and convict leasing. And I was struck by really the brutality of convict leasing, because in the North, you could rent a convict, say, for $12 a month. And then the person worked for you all day long, and then they went back to the prison. But in the South, you bought a person for $12 a month, and you could work them to death, which is what many of the industries did. Many of them, like the sugar, sugar cane fields, all the sugar companies, mining, all the jobs that were dangerous, that they did not want white people to do, they just basically purchased a human being, the continuation of slavery, and just worked them to death. And some of them were children. And so when I looked at that and looked at how, you know, even today, how we, so many times, young black children under 18 go to, well, I think it was 50% of them, more than 50, go to are tried as adults, you know, how that happens to them. Even though, well, the figure is like, when black youth represented 14% of youth under 18, they represented more than 50% of youth that were tried as adults. So it's just this continuation, and Keith can speak to this too. We spend a lot of time being depressed, I think, and also being very angry because angry. Yeah, while we're researching and writing this, we're living through, you know, not only George Floyd, but the deaths that followed, the killings that followed after that. As you know, we're living through all of this too while we're digging into this, you know, this horrible history. And as I said, there was a time when, you know, when you're doing a story and you get a little down, you go out and you meet a friend maybe for a beer or something, or you go have a good meal, or you go on a trip. Well, you couldn't do any of that because of the pandemic. So it was really the 6 months, I say, were in some ways very hellish, you know. It's been difficult for everybody, but to also be steeped in this research was very difficult.
Yeah,
I think we're all very happy that we did the work.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the prison leasing, prison slavery, Louisiana State Penitentiary, Angola was notorious for that for many, many decades. To the issue of Black Lives Matter, Keith, outside of the issues of police, are we seeing this phrase, if not indeed, but in the thought process of almost everything that we do now? And I use another story that that came up again. It happens to be yet another issue regarding the NFL, the race norming as it relates to the settlements for concussions and how some retired players got less than white players who retired or nothing at all. That's an example, but it could be used in non-sports related incidents. The story out of the University of North Carolina, the court decision saying that university can consider race when it brings students into the system. Is Black Lives Matter just another name for what we've been saying all along as Black people, the I told you so, that race is and should always be a consideration when looking at how Black people are treated in America?
I'm glad you brought up in particular the NFL example, because clearly Curtis Bunn, one of the co-authors, wrote about a couple of sections, but he wrote about a healthcare system in this country and how because of COVID that more Black and brown people proportionately died from that than white people did. But there's a reason for that. One of them is what you just cited, is because how the medical community looks at people of color. They don't look at us and treat us the same way that white people get treated. There was an example I think that Curtis uses in here of a medical doctor, a Black woman, I think she was in Texas, who had COVID-19, and she was trying to get treated. The medical staff that she went to for treatment essentially sent her home. And Patrice, if I'm forgetting some details, please step in. But essentially sent her home. She had the presence of mind to essentially record herself on social media.
Yeah.
Outline what was happening to her.
Right.
She ended up dying.
Yeah, that was a really big issue. I believe that was last year. There was a lot of discussion, but not as much discussion, I think, as there should have been.
Well, but the thing is, that's a symptom of something that's way, it's just more widespread. I mean, I am going to keep this tied to the medical part.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the people that I talked to for the policing section is a legal scholar on policing at Georgetown University, a woman. And she said, look, you know, if we were talking about defunding the police and pros and cons. And she said, look, if you got rid of all the police departments in this country tomorrow by some miracle, and you did that, you still wouldn't put a dent in the number of Black people in particular who die because of systemic racism in the medical profession. And because the two numbers dwarf each other. If you think about, as bad as the numbers are for police shootings, for instance, I think in 2020 it was about a Black person was shot and killed by a police officer in this country once every 38 hours. But she says, put those numbers up against the number of Black people who died from COVID because they didn't receive the correct treatment for COVID, or they didn't get adequate treatment for diseases that they had for whatever reason. And it starts to, when Patrice says it starts, all of this, when you're sort of like hearing this over and over again in a short amount of time, it starts to weigh on you. But that, the medical disparities and the economic injustices are the two biggest topics that to me really sort of are the foundation for everything else that happens in our communities.
I wanted to mention also, in one of the things that Curtis had covered in talking about the whole medical field also was just the way the myths that even medical students today have about Black people, which you know, makes me think about the whole NFL thing, although, of course, there were a lot of things, I'm sure, that weighed in on those decisions. But things that where they believe that we could handle pain better, where we had thicker skin, and therefore, you know, things that impacted the health of a white person wouldn't impact us as much. So, I mean, just to know those kinds of myths still exist, you know, of course, has a profound impact on the kind of health care that we receive also.
Mm-hmm. The next thing I was going to mention also, Patrice, is outside the life or death issues. But I think the more cultural, social issues, we could talk about, you know, corporate America. I'm sure that, you know, both of you and I have been around long enough to see how even in large newsrooms, not here because I work for a black organization, but when I did not, how black lives, black issues, and the nuances of black culture played a role in how we are seen and how we cover things. And even outside of newsrooms where we may have, you know, more black people who have, you know, corporate jobs, you know, and that this new corporate culture of high tech, particularly on the West Coast, or these days it's we say it's on the West Coast, but it's everywhere because you can do it from home. But, you know, talk to me about that piece, you know, Patrice, and how black, you know, more broadly, black culture matters, how the lives of black people function and interact with the larger society, and how these mistakes are made, and these teachable moments, and how we still must ride the fence, and it's like a whack-a-mole for so many of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see if I'm following your question, and then Keith, feel free to jump in also. But one of the things that I thought of when you were talking, Harold, was how, in many ways, social media has helped us, because anybody can, you know, turn on a camera and show what's really happening and show the truth. Whereas, you know, many of us, well, the three of us, I'm sure, had this experience of when you were working in a media that doesn't always appreciate or even understand your culture. They devalue it, or they don't see, like, I speaking just personally, I know there were times, I remember once I was working on a case for a long time. I worked on trying to prove that the guys arrested in the notorious 8th and H Street crew murder, the murder of Catherine Fuller, were innocent. And, you know, we went all the way to the Supreme Court and unfortunately lost there, but it wasn't a unanimous decision. But when I was working on that, I remember a editor saying that I was obsessed with this, as if that was a bad thing. And I thought I had to step back and think, now, if it had been a different story, isn't obsession, can't that be a very good thing, you know, to get to the bottom of something? But I know I had times when people did not see the value of the stories that I wanted to write about, or that I did write about, you know, that things that were going on in the black community in Washington, D.C., that other folks just did not think were things that we should cover. And so I don't know if that, you know, answers their question. I do think that in today's world, one of the things that has helped us to counter that, though, is social media, that even the main media, you know, the old traditional media, is watching that. They have to see that, too. They can't deny that. They can't say that doesn't exist, because you know, those young people that stood around and took that video of George Floyd taking his last breath. There was no way to deny that. And so, that's been a big game changer.
Well, and I think, you know, as the world begins to change, and social media may be a part of it, but I also believe, to the point, and having worked in the South and in the West, I think, you know, Keith is absolutely right, and I've said this for many, many years, you can be a white person in parts of this country and never, ever see or have any interaction with black people. And you can buy a car, you can buy a house, you can go to the grocery store, you can go to church. You can be born and you can die. And you can never, ever have any face-to-face real interaction with black people, because black people, and I'm talking black people, I'm not talking about, you know, the whole broader conversation about people of color, but I'm just talking about black people. And because I've covered news in those towns where I may have been the first one that, you know, that was seen even as recently as, you know, the 1990s. But I think what is happening now, you know, to Patrice's point, where we have social media, is that the exposure to black culture, where you may have, you know, well-meaning white people who may be curious and say, what is that? Again, another sports analogy, and I'm not a sports person, so I'm really kind of surprised at myself because I brought up sports three times. But the thing that really struck me, and I think all three of, both of you will appreciate this, and this happened, I don't know, earlier this year, maybe it was even, I don't know, last year, where, and don't ask me the name of the guy or the team, but I remember that somebody had, you know, he intercepted a ball, scored a touchdown or whatever. He was a player, black player, and he began to step. He was a member of Omega Psi Phi. But the white sports announcer was talking about him dancing. He was not insulting. He was just saying, you know, he was celebrating. Well, because his interaction with black people, and probably he didn't go to an HBCU, I am quite sure, but he knew nothing about Omega Psi Phi. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Q, I'm a Kappa, but I recognize the Q step. And I think even something like that, and that's what I mean by not so much black lives, but black culture matters. And there are things that if you're going to interact with black people in an intelligent space, in a safe space, there are things that you have to know, because historically, guess what? We have had to know about them.
Yeah. It hasn't gone both ways. Go ahead, Patrice. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, thank you. Kind of answers that yourself, Harold, when you say we had to know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Our survival depended on having to know. You know, when I grew up partially in Buford, South Carolina, and I know we had to know. You know, we had to know where we could go, where we couldn't go, why. We had to know who, you know, certain people were. But that was our survival. We had to know. We didn't get to choose that. And I think the practice of that, in many ways, even though you could say in some ways more subtle, we still have to know.
Mm-hmm.
And until people understand, I mean, I'm talking about white people, too, that don't get it, understand that their lives are enriched. And not only enriched, but there's so much more knowledge that they could have if they had to know also, you know. But it's because of all those things, those images, everything that presents us as thugs and as in other ways that don't show our humanity and all that we're capable of. And, you know, don't even get me started about the potential that we have locked up and locked away because we over-incarcerate and, you know, disregard people and all of that stuff, change them. But, yeah, you know, we have to get to a point where people understand, they have to know too, where it has to be in some ways the quality of their life has to depend on their knowing also.
I only have a couple of minutes left, but and I'll ask this of both of you. What do you want people to come away with when they read this book, Keith, short of depression and anger?
I think it's good for people to, I think one of the best things about this book is that it covers several topics, the Black Lives Matter movement, economics, policing, incarceration, the Black church, and politics, and a couple of others. But to have it in one volume and to read it from cover to cover, you come away with a sense of, again, with a good explanation and with a historical context about why the situations in this country exist. There are reasons for it. It didn't happen by happenstance. And I think, you know, it's not as if this is what we get in our institutions of education, not from top to bottom anyway. So that's the thing, I think. To get people to see that there is a reason for the way we exist in this country, and that there are some things that we can do about them that we all outline in our chapters.
Patrice?
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, yeah, believe it or not, Harold, hope. I think in each one of us in our chapters, as we ended our chapters, we talked about the visionaries who are doing the work. In each of those, whether it's in the medical field, whether it's on police reform, whether it's we're talking about abolitionists who, you know, are demanding that we think of punishment or not even a punitive a punishment as being the answer to creating a safer country, a safe, you know, safer public. So I think that you can actually walk away with hope, because you not only will get to read about these visionaries and their work, but you'll also see where we have come from. I mean, how much we truly have accomplished is just incredible. Yeah. When you consider the forces that have tried to work against us.
The book is Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. Patrice Gaines and Keith Harrison, thank you both for talking to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Harold.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, October 19th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.